Welcome. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. We've got a short order of business today. We're going to do a work session on restraints bill and then an informational meeting after that. So let's get this out of the way first. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2939A. Now, Linda, if you could just refresh us on Treasurer and the amendment.
House Bill 2939 restricts certain use of mechanical restraints, chemical restraint, and prone restraint on students in public education programs. It does allow the use of restraints or seclusion on a student in public education program under specific circumstances. It describes the procedures to be followed if restraint or seclusion are used. It requires preparation of an annual report related to the use of physical restraint or seclusion. It directs the Department of Education to approve training programs in restraint that meet Department of Human Services standards. There was an amendment that we adopted last week that provides for a sunset on the prohibition in 5 years to assure legislative review, and it restores original language that says an individual may use reasonable force if they believe it necessary to maintain order in the school classroom activity or event.
Okay, thank you. We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2939A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2939A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We have adopted the amendment.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I missed one of the meetings on this bill. I just wanted to make a comment that I had heard some concern from the Beaverton School District about the additional burdens placed on the district, but it's my understanding also that that comment was made without understanding that the reporting requirement was taken out. And so I'm going to be supporting this bill. I think in the balance it's good policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? There are objections? Seeing none, the measure passes. House Bill 2939A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Shields, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2939, and we're going to open up an informational meeting on Study Oregon assessments. Do you have a little overview?
Study Oregon. They're two different.
I'm sorry, Study Oregon and assessments.
Okay, certainly. As an introduction, as business and cultures transcend national borders, educational institutions need to think globally and prepare graduates to work across communities and countries. Globalization of our society is the product of more rapid communication, technology, and the flow of ideas, people, and information. Leading higher education institutions have recognized this trend of transnational collaboration by internationalizing their campuses. To remain competitive, it is important to increase the number and the diversity of international students in Oregon to enrich classrooms with multiple perspectives. Today's presentations will inform the committee on what Oregon is doing to promote academic and intellectual exchange between individuals and nations.
Okay. So we're going to go down this list here. Mm-hmm. Let's start off with Julie Walken, Amy Akimoff, Dan Ferguson.
So, good afternoon, and thank you, Senator Haas, and greetings, Senator Shields, Senator Morse, Senator Lindholm, Senator George, and Senator Bonamici. Appreciate this opportunity to provide you, a capstone or an additional opportunity in this informational hearing setting to share with you what Study Oregon as a consortium endeavors to achieve, and to put it a little bit into context in terms of how important it is that our higher educational institutions are increasing their international student enrollment, and all in an effort of further internationalization, as Linda articulated. And then we're also going to leave the floor really to you all to have a robust Q&A session with four international students who have joined us today. And you'll have an opportunity to meet them and hear a little bit about their own experiences here in Oregon, and perhaps even some ideas and recommendations about how Oregon can go forward with being an even more attractive place as a host for international students. So again, to put this into context, higher education inherently needs to be, in these days and times, internationalized in the fullest sense. Many people talk about it as a comprehensive, ongoing effort at many, many levels. As you articulated, Senator Haas, the academic level is, of course, the heart and soul of what's happening in our tertiary institutions. But it also impacts the experience on the campus personally and professionally. For those of us who are in the field of international education, we are obviously strong advocates of the positive outcomes that are achieved through internationalization. And then it's just the reality in this global economy that we have to be engaged in to every extent possible. So one of the handouts I think shared with you earlier, which is the IIE's or Institute for International Education report on international education as an institutional priority, is a great way of sort of articulating what are those important metrics that every tertiary institution should reflect upon and be contemplating ardently to see how their institution can achieve these goals relative to its own mission. So some of those key examples which are on this first slide is simply that we need to ensure that our Oregonian students have opportunities to study abroad and to be immersed in other cultures. You know, it's not enough just to be introduced to friends on Facebook who come from another country. You really have to be in that setting and live the rhythm of that life and culture and function effectively to really gain those skill sets and hopefully bring those back to Oregon. Universities are also charged with facilitating the learning of other languages and cultures, obviously, or area studies, as it's often called. It's really important that we are examining very closely the whole curriculum itself, and to what extent are we maybe just looking at the local but not recognizing the value and the power of having a global perspective in any topic area, any major, any field of study, including mathematics. And then there's the faculty development. Clearly developing institutional partnerships as well. The last I've highlighted, because that's really where Study Oregon comes into play, is that we are really focused on the recruitment, the retention, and hopefully the integration of our international students, both on our campuses and within the larger community. And that's where Oregon itself, you know, where students end up after graduation can and what kinds of ties and connections will they have with Oregon, not only individuals and professors, but perhaps with our companies and our businesses in terms of helping us further our competitive advantage. We covered a lot of some of the general data about the impact of international students across the United States as a whole. Currently, we host well over 690,000 international students. That's projected to continue to increase. The reality is there is increasing demand, But there's also increasing supply, if you will, supply by institutions throughout the United States as well as in other countries who recognize the value of having international students for the purpose of strengthening the institution itself, the learning environment, but also political and sociocultural ties and relationships. Overview is also in the handout, which really does boil it down to the fact that it is really the fifth largest export industry in the United States, and even in the state of Oregon may qualify in one of our leading export industries, right up there with forestry and athletic apparel and those sorts of things when you look at what our 45 accredited tertiary institutions in the state can do.
Julie, can you back up the microphone? Just
to yes, speak? Yes, okay.
It's a little too close. You don't need to be that
thank
close.
You, okay. There's also the capacity issue. In the United States, on average, we may only have about 3% international student enrollment, whereas a lot of countries, namely Australia, New Zealand, even UK, often have upwards of 15 and 20% international student enrollment. I think here in the U.S., the goal is to have at least 8 to 10%. Certainly that's the case for Oregon State University, and I'm not sure of other institutions, but largely we see the value in having that critical mass. Just a note about the estimated revenue that's generated through our international recruitment efforts. The reality is the majority of students are paying through private funds. However, I also like to point out that at least nationally, about a quarter of international students, and this includes all degree levels, are also supported by colleges and universities. And that's an important element to point out because they are contributing, especially your master's and PhD students, toward research and that sort of thing. So clearly, it's an investment that's well worthwhile. So bringing it down to Oregon, I think we are looking at approximately 8,000 international students that currently attend, mainly these 25 institutions who are members of Study Oregon. And basically we have a majority population probably from Asia-Pacific Rim, not surprising based on our geographic location, but clearly these are really important statistics that we only hope will increase with some very comprehensive efforts on the part of many of our institutions. Just a quick snapshot at some of our neighboring states. Looking at California, the powerhouse to the south, obviously with well over 90,000 students, they are very attractive. And then Washington, of course, to the north, is also has a very robust international student population. Today's speakers, our guest students, are actually three out of the four are graduate students. In the United States as a whole, it's kind of half and half, with undergraduates comprising nearly 40%, master's and PhD students, again, a little over 40%. And then you also have the students who really need intensive English or academic preparation, and that is, that 8% is significant, but we also like to point out the curricular and optional practical training demographic, if you will. These represent the international students who have actually completed their program of study and are now gaining work experience in the United States while on their student visa, again, a benefit of that status. And that's a really important area that we in Oregon want to be taking advantage of, as do other states who have graduates from their state institutions. Just a quick breakdown on what fields of study tend to be most popular. Business and engineering, right up at the top, and that's great for many of our institutions. Many of those who are represented here on the panel too, noting that we have very strong business or engineering programs. So let's talk a little bit about Study Oregon, and I'm going to invite Dan Ferguson, who is from Concordia University, to maybe share a little bit about, again, the consortium in a nutshell.
Sure. Okay. Study Oregon, as maybe you have heard before.
Start off with your name, Dan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Name is Dan Ferguson. I work at Concordia University in international admissions and recruitment. And Study Oregon is a consortium of 25 accredited Oregon colleges and universities that comprise two-year, four-year, and professional studies. We represent both the public and private universities and colleges in the state of Oregon. And the focus on connecting students and professionals with quality in education and training is something that we've been doing for more than 15 years. Okay. The nicest thing about working together with people like Julie and Amy and others that are part of the Study Oregon leadership is the fact that we're working together and the opportunity to bring students into the state of Oregon. You know, we're obviously working to bring in students and, you know, in a sense in competition with each other, but in this sense we're also working together in trying to bring students in general to Oregon. So we're all enjoying the opportunity to work together in bringing these students here. The focus of Study Oregon is to market and promote Oregon higher education. The individual institutions, of course, manage their own international student recruitment strategies, ranging from what is called armchair recruitment to extensive outreach, which would include, of course, traveling to those particular countries where we either have a market or are interested in developing the market. There are opportunities to, of course, attend educational fairs overseas. And all of us in this role have done that at one time or another. Of course, we are in contact with educational agents around the world, representatives, who, of course, bring interest to our universities here in Oregon, to students that would have no idea where Oregon even is. Okay. We use web-based and social media and do broad-based campaigns that will include actually some of the things that we bring about as I talk about the initiatives that we're currently doing at this moment and into the future. There you see on the next page the 25 member institutions of Study Oregon. And then I just want to briefly talk about the initiatives that Study Oregon is involved in at the present. Within the past year, we've launched an interactive e-brochure. And, of course, I invite those of you who are interested to visit that site. You will see various things that are about specific universities as well as the universities in general in Oregon. This coming next week, many of us will be in Vancouver, B.C., where NAVSA, which is basically our professional society that we're involved in to promote international education, both incoming and outgoing, meeting up in Vancouver, B.C., from May 30 to June 3rd. And at that time, we'll host a reception, which we've done so for the past 5 years. And there we'll meet various people from Education USA offices located abroad to welcome them to our reception and, of course, talk more about what Oregon universities and education is all about. We'll meet host Education USA advisors actually tomorrow. There will be a number of them coming to Lewis and Clark College to meet many of us and to talk about not only our individual universities, but of course all of the universities in Oregon. We host networking workshops with high school college advisors, admission counselors, who have an increasing number of international students. And I see that in every place that I have gone to do recruiting here regionally and locally in the private high schools as well as the public high schools. Targeted outreach to emerging markets. Of all these three that you see listed, Turkey, Taiwan, and China, all of them are on the top of what is called Open Doors, which is the source that we cite of how many students are actually coming into the United States and specifically into each state. And we see, of course, Turkey and Taiwan and China being really the big markets that are bringing in international students. We mobilize materials and representation in conjunction with the Oregon Trade Missions abroad. We conduct spring seminars that focus on recruitment strategies, and we do that during the springtime. And during the year, of course, we also meet virtually every month to talk about recruitment strategies as well amongst us. And we administer what is the Study Oregon Scholarship, which is $1,000. Is that correct? Yeah, for specific individuals who meet the essay requirement that we have. So those are some of the things that we've done thus far and into the future.
Appreciate it.
Just a quick note on we are probably one of the older state consortia, believe it or not. The Chronicle of Higher Education recently had an article just maybe a month ago highlighting the burgeoning, the growth of these state consortia, because now maybe half of this 50 states actually have an organization like ours working toward this goal, but that means about half aren't there yet. So we're really on a little bit on the cutting edge, but it is very challenging when we are both competitors with one another on one level and very strapped with maybe our own priorities and emphases and that sort of thing, but at the same time we recognize that by working together we can definitely achieve helping Oregon be on the mental map more effectively than if we were working solely as a single institution. But we are we work all of our individual institutions as well as the consortium tap into many a federal and state agency that also help us along the way. Namely, we mentioned the Education USA centers, of which there are some 400 around the world. That's through the U.S. Department of State. Also, the U.S. Department of Commerce is very much involved. In fact, they'll have a pretty significant presence at this NAFSA conference we referred to next week. They understand that it's really important to help facilitate those connections between institutions and prospective students within a set country and the specific ties that we can have here in the state of Oregon or U.S. as a whole. We also have a tremendous amount of support from Business Oregon, and through that, all kinds of channels of helping us connect with these opportunities to promote our institutions, i.e. through trade missions in particular, have been really helpful. And then finally, we all work with and even advocate on behalf of our consortium with agencies like Immigration and Customs and enforcement at PDX and helping them know us, you know, to be able to troubleshoot when situations arise. And so there is that advocacy element that's been very productive for us, too. I would like to ask Amy Akimoff from Willamette University to introduce our four panelists, and also, I think, just open the floor to any kind of questions that you may have from any of us three, as well as the student guests with us today. Thank you.
So my name is Amy Akimoff, and I work just across the street over at Willamette University, specifically in the MBA program, Director of Recruitment. And I think to sort of put a face behind all of this, it's very interesting to see our students here able to talk about their experience here in the U.S. I think one of the most important aspects of bringing international students here is that they actually contribute to our communities, not just in an economic sense, but also in a volunteering capacity. We actually have incorporated into our MBA program a project where students actually are partnered with nonprofit organizations, usually in the Portland or Salem area, and they provide valuable consulting services for the nonprofits, and they're giving back their time, their resources, and this is incorporated into our program, and I think a lot of the other institutions have very similar programs. So international students are in a very big way contributing to our economy and to our communities at large. So on that note, I'd actually like to turn it over to the students so that they can share a personal story and testimony of their time here. And just bring them up and they can introduce their names. Go ahead.
Why don't you all come on up and just start off with start off your testimonial with telling us who you are and go from there. You've got to get a couch for this. Anybody?
Okay, so starting with me, my name is Ray Chen Hong, and I'm from Taiwan. And allow me to give you a very warming Chinese greeting, ni hao. And yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Dipankar Shrestha Tamang, and I'm an international student from Kathmandu, Nepal. And we'd say namaste.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Oluwa Funcho Farinde. I'm from Nigeria. And I would like to say, Ekujoko.
Hello, I've been here before, recognize some faces. My name is Osama Lagdar-Ghazal, and I'm from France and Morocco. I would like to say bienvenue in French and marhaba in Arabic.
And we will say hello. Did you have something that you wanted to give us first, or would you want us to just ask you some questions? Let me start off with saying how was it that you chose Oregon?
Okay, so starting with me, I'm Ray Chen Hong once again. The reason I chose Oregon is because one of the objectives for international students who share the same background like me, learning the language is probably the first goal that we try to achieve. Comparing to Washington and California, we have less density of Chinese people here in the States. So, and one of the reasons that I chose Oregon is because probably I can have better English practice experience here. And my parents think that, you know, Oregon probably I won't get into any trouble because I have less friends here. If looking at learning the language, I think I will definitely have better learning, more productivity here than in Washington and Oregon. And that's one of the reasons I end up here choosing Oregon.
Okay, yeah. So I'm here primarily because of a scholarship program that we have in Oregon State University. It's actually under the Oregon University system as well, Western Oregon University, University of Oregon. It's called the International Cultural Service Program, ICSP. So without the ICSP scholarship, I wouldn't be here for my education. So it's a scholarship program for international students, mostly undergraduates. We get a partial tuition remission in exchange for community service of about 27 hours every term, and that entails giving presentations about our country and culture. So as an ICSP student, I'm basically like a cultural ambassador, if you will. I give presentations about Nepal. Usually the topics are very general and sometimes even more specific. I'm asked to talk about politics or status of women in Nepal, so I have to present on university classrooms. I recently presented on for a global women's studies class. Other times I'm invited to places like churches, retirement homes, schools, elementary schools, and middle schools, so it's I get requests to present on a variety of locations. And ICSP was primarily my motive for coming here, because unlike India and Nepal, which are emerging economies, Nepal is sandwiched right in between India and China, and Nepal is very much a developing country. It's one of the poorest nations in the world. So coming to Oregon, sitting in the U.S. is a really big deal for an international student from Nepal, such as myself. So through the ICSP program at Oregon State University, that is how I am here.
My name is Funshar. I actually found out about Oregon State University through a friend that applied for the MBE program, which is the Master's in Business Engineering. But unfortunately, he wasn't admitted, and he was sharing his story with me, and that was how I got to know about OSU, and I applied, and I was given admission, and that's why I'm here today.
So coming from Southwest France and Morocco, I didn't come from the rain, right? One of the reasons, I think there are a couple of reasons. Doing business, I think Oregon has a big competitive advantage in terms of companies that are headquartered around here, like Nike or even the companies that are headquartered in Washington, Intel or Microsoft. So that's part of why I came here. But for a financial perspective, I would lie if I wouldn't share with you that I also came. Part of the reason was the scholarship that was offered to me by the Willamette Atkinson Graduate School of Management. It's very attractive. I actually had a choice to come back to France, to stay in Morocco, or to continue traveling around. And English, becoming more and more fluent in English, was also a big argument in the decision. As far as Oregon is concerned, the natural the nature and all the outdoor activities that are available to us here, which really contrasts with California and huge cities like the Bay Area or Seattle in Washington. I think that's also something that was attractive to me. When I first visited, I had a chance to see the Oregon coast, I had a chance to see the Silver Falls, and all that is part of the attraction.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming to the committee. I've been concerned for a long time that students in the United States tend to be monolingual. We don't have enough language requirements for students to study another language, and you are all pretty fluent in English. So could you talk a little bit about when you started learning English and what other languages you speak, just to sort of educate us about how many languages you've studied and when you started learning them? Thank you.
So starting with me, English is actually my second language that I've learned. And if you notice that in Taiwan, we starting learning English starting from elementary school education. And it was very, by that time, learning English is just for academic purposes. And but we do not have that real experience using the language, so it tends to be just to, you know, learn it to make it through the test. But when I'm actually here in the States and when I have to immerse to a foreign language, and that's when I started learning. And at first it's really hard because I think through Chinese and then convert that into English. So that takes my brain a little bit time to process. Just like when I'm doing my graduation paperwork, it takes me usually twice of the time to complete my task. So it's very hard. Each language have their own very special structure and expression, and this is why it's so important for me to come out here to a foreign country to learn my target language, and it is fun. It is fun. Thank you.
Okay, so back in Nepal, we have quite a few languages, actually. There are about 90 different languages because Nepal is a very ethnically diverse country. I'm coming from two different ethnic backgrounds myself. My mother is from a different ethnic background, and my father is from a different ethnic background. So I actually know four languages. English is my third language. So I speak Nepali, which is the official language in Nepal. I also speak a language called Nawari, which is what the original inhabitants of my city, the Kathmandu Valley, those were the Nawari people. So that's where the language originated from. And I speak Hindi as well, probably because we're so close to India and the indirect influence of Bollywood film industry. A lot of people, Nepali youth, they catch on pretty quick. And for me, I was fortunate to have grown up with a strong English background, because it's funny, the norm is usually international students, especially from South Asia, they're really strong in the maths and the sciences, and their English is horrible, usually the written and the vocal part. But it was just the opposite with me. I was always more comfortable in English, and I was definitely more inclined towards the social sciences than engineering or math. And probably my mother, she actually did her master's in English and linguistics. So she coached me as I grew up, and she made sure I read a lot of books, out knowledge books, not just textbooks. So early on, I really was exposed to different kinds of books, and, you know, my mother in general, she kind of taught English to me, so I was comfortable growing up in English. And a lot of international students, usually we have to take a TOEFL exam, the test of English as a foreign language, before we get admitted to the university. That's one of the conditions.
excuse me. Coming from a country with over 250 languages, mm-hmm. Yeah, I come from Nigeria, who happens to be the most populated country in Africa. Though we have quite a number of languages, English happens to be our official language because we were colonized by the British. So through all our education system, it's our mode of teaching is in English. So I actually learned how to write since I was elementary all through my university. And out of the languages we speak in Nigeria, like I said, we have over 250 languages, but we have three major languages. I speak two and a half. I speak two, then I speak a bit of the third one. So I think learning English has been something I've cultivated right from ours in the elementary school. You know, so it's something we would learn all through our schooling, our education period.
As for me, I do speak four languages, five if we include the Moroccan dialects of kind of different from standard Arabic. I understand your concern, and I think among the things that I've witnessed in the U.S., that's correct, that languages is not something that people around here are strong in. Many of the American people I've met wish they could travel around, but they would argue, I only speak English. And so they see it as a barrier for them to go around the globe and explore because they have a hard time communicating with other people. In terms of the educational system, I think that's what really helped me to speak those four languages, which are French, Arabic, Spanish, and English, mainly, is that at the equivalent of the sixth grade here, we have to take a first language, and we have the choice among English, Spanish, German, Russian, and all those languages. I'm talking about France right now. And then the equivalent here of the eighth grade, we have to take another one. And so when we graduate from high school, we already have 7 years of the first languages we've chosen and five of the second, which give a pretty strong exposure. I took English and Spanish, and so when I graduated from high school, I had, and those were, by the way, fields that I had to take for my baccalaureate, so I was actually having exams on those languages. So I really think I would agree with you that that really helps in the educational system to study those languages early on.
Thank you. I think the American strategy is we just hope everybody else understands English.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, I did. So you're already being diplomatic. Well, we very much thank you for coming and sharing your lives with us, and wish you best success in your career. And we join you in looking at the importance to increase the diversity of international students, international study in this state and abroad, to bring our global community closer together. Isn't that the goal? So thank you for checking in with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on this, and I'm going to open up an informational hearing on assessments. We checked in with this subject a few weeks ago on a hearing that I think raised more questions, and so because assessments and testing has become so much more sophisticated in just the last 4 or 5 years, I thought it'd be a good idea to have Doug Costi from the department kind of give us a status report on where we are now, what we're doing, where we're going, and whether we need to pause and look at any changes. Doug.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Doug Costi. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services for the Department of Education. And let me thank you for allowing me to speak today to give you some background on assessment. My intent is to spend, my understanding is I've got about 30 minutes, and you should each have a document of some major speaking points that I've pulled together for this presentation. I don't need to go through each and every one of them, and I can be flexible with respect to your time. So my initial thought was I'd spend about 15 or 20 minutes presenting, giving you a brief overview of the history, how we got to where we are today, what we're doing today, and where we're going with the assessments and the Common Core standards in the future. But this will leave a lot of topics open. It's a very broad subject area. There's a lot of complexities to it. So my intent with this meeting was to give you a good flavor of the history and the background and what the assessment system looks like, and maybe spur some questions and thoughts on what you might want to hear would be interesting going forward. So if that meets with your approval, I'll move forward. So under the background statement that I've provided for you, Oregon's assessment system has been around for decades, and it's purpose has changed over the years from looking at the performance of districts to drilling into schools and districts to looking at demographic subgroups, student subcategories of performance, down to looking at individual student performance. And as a result of that, we're providing information to you folks for policy decisions. I think you hear quite often about the testing results, the assessment results of our students across the state. That's in part thanks to this standardized system that we've been we've put in place and that the legislature has helped funded over these last several decades. We also want to point out that the assessment system also addresses technical adequacy. We want to ensure that this is a valid and reliable instrument and that you can use those results over time and that we follow best practices and ethical processes. And when I say ethical processes, I mean we address the needs of all students, specifically kids that are English language learners, like the group of kids we just saw. For those kids coming into the country, allowing them to have a means whereby they can be tested and the reports on those kids can be displayed, as well as students with disability who might need accommodations for testing and special modifications for their assessment systems. In short, for the background, I'd like to say that we believe we designed a system that is cost-effective, it's timely, it's practical, and provides useful information to a variety of audiences. Then I thought it would be important that we give some background on the history from a federal and a state perspective to give you folks an idea of why we started testing and the impetus for it and how it came about in Oregon and evolved over the years. Testing started through a survey process similar to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, where the a sampling of kids across districts were tested, and we provided district-level results, but not every kid was tested in those school districts. That happened in the 70s and 80s. In 1989, the legislature approved funding for a common statewide assessment that allowed us to go in and create a census-type survey. So we tested every kid, and we posted results by school and district, and this began to emerge in 1991 was also the marked the passage of the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century and the desire to look at state assessments being used for the certificate of initial mastery so that we could use these assessments to really start to focus on student level performance. In 95, Oregon received a $2 million four-year grant to look at the processes and procedures that we use to develop our assessment system. And I brought a book along that was edited and co-produced by Dr. Jerry Tyndall from the University of Oregon and Dr. Tom Holladinha from Arizona State University. This was basically the work product or the culmination of efforts from that federal grant. It also provided us with a great framework and created our first National Technical Advisory Committee, which we continue to staff today. So we pull together national experts to look at our assessment system as the federal and state mandates change and give us guidance on how we need to tweak it so that it more accurately reflects these new purposes coming forth. Then 1999 was really a pivotal year. Up until 1999, we had basically assessments that were based off of content standards, and that's typically how most states have built large-scale assessments. In 1999, legislature passed Senate Bill 1329, requiring the Department of Education to create and administer a school report card. And that report card was first published in 2000, and that was the first time we started assigning grades or ratings to schools across the state based on the performance of their students on these assessments. 1999 also marked the pilot of our online assessment system. This is when we started to move to a computer administered assessment. And just for way of history, in 2001 we ran a pilot of 10 school districts. By 2004, 2005, over 80% of our assessments were online, and today all assessments with the exception of our Braille assessments are online, and we're in the final process of creating a process for all of our blind and visually impaired school students to receive the assessment. assessment in a Braille format. We were one of the first states to be fully approved for technical adequacy on our assessment system. And in 2007, the Oregon State Board of Education adopted the new graduation requirements, which adopted essential skills and the associated policy that would allow or require the use of OAKS, or would allow the use of OAKS to be one potential source of evidence for students to demonstrate their mastery in reading, mathematics, and writing. And then I listed some federally mandated requirements. I talk about in 1983, the Nation at Risk was published, commissioned, and that really was a reform effort that moved at a national level. And in 2002, the No Child Left Behind Act was adopted and required all schools and districts to be tested using common statewide assessments. And previously, it was just Title I schools. Which leads me to the implications of these policies on our assessments. As you can see, the assessments began as an informational resource and tool, and they have emerged into a more high-stakes and pressure-focused system for teachers and administrators, and they feel it today. The federal government has also taken a very strict compliance approach to states using these assessments and monitor our work through what's called a peer review process, where we have to produce exhaustive documentation on the technical adequacy of our assessment, how it's built, and how it's being administered. Today, the current state of OAKS is a criterion reference test, which is different than a normed reference test. A criterion reference test is based on a set of standards and criteria for expectation of what kids ought to know, as opposed to a norm reference test where you take the average performance and figure out what the scale ought to be. So essentially, we create a thermometer for testing, and we create achievement standards according to that scale to allow comparison to the content standards. So it doesn't matter how many kids meet the standard. It really matters that this is the standard that we expect kids to get to, and it's not norm referenced. The OAKS is different from most other state-based assessments. I think you've all heard us testify in the past. It's computer-based. It's adaptive, which means that instead of a fixed form that most states use, which are basically the same sets of questions given to a student to answer, our tests are delivered in a format that allows the test to level on its own. So if a kid continues to receive more difficult questions and he submits the correct answers, he will continue to get more and more difficult questions, which allows us to spread out the measurement scale and do a more accurate read on how well they're doing, not only at meeting standards, but exceeding and not meeting standard. Gives us a broader scale range. And it allows us to ask fewer questions. The other thing that's different about Oregon's assessment is, unlike most states, thanks to the work that we did back in 1995, we have not relied extensively on external contractors. The Oregon assessment system is built with the technology and the expertise of the staff within the department and across the field, across the state. So we have very experienced staff that are really good at developing test items, working with us. We are fairly economical with it, with the process for creating items, for field testing these items, and making them operational. We allow up to 3 opportunities for testing, which allows schools and districts to decide when it's appropriate to test their students, and allows students to retry if they have a if they need to. And it also, we're working on best practices guides following Senator Bonamici's bill, Senate Bill 801. And we've got a draft out. In fact, the state board is looking at our first cut of it, and then we're going to get ready to release it to the field shortly. We have a longer testing window first than other states, and kids and teachers get the results almost immediately. We also have a writing performance assessment that is based on standardized scoring guides and criteria, and provides analytical scoring guides for teachers and creates a standard vocabulary for discussing how kids are doing with their writing. And over the past 25 years, we've had thousands of Oregon teachers trained to score students in writing, and some of them have said that it's one of the most valuable professional developments that they have received. We also have English language proficiency assessment, and this is an assessment that every state has to administer. We have about 60,000 English language learners in the state that have to take this assessment from grades K through 12. It's similar to the gentleman's test of English language fluency that some of these folks take to get into college. It tests the speaking, listening, writing and reading domains, and it's a very unique test. And then we also have established a set of performance tasks. So we develop criteria for these performance tasks that are administered locally in the areas of science inquiry, engineering design, math problem solving, and writing. So not only do we develop the writing assessments that are going statewide, there's also this criteria, this framework for local performance assessments that are administered locally. Then under the the other thing that's important is OAKS is referred to as a summative assessment, which means it's used for accountability purposes primarily. And the other various types of assessments are formative, which is more of a process that incorporates instruction into the testing activities on a daily basis. So teachers get immediate feedback from the kids on how well they're doing in different areas. And interim assessments, which build up to or provide incremental views of how kids are doing in content areas, in sub-scoring or sub-reporting categories of a content area. And I've listed all of the different assessment types. We also have what's referred to as an extended assessment, and these are for our most seriously challenged students with disabilities so that they have a means to test aligned with our content standards. This committee's asked for the cost of the assessment in the past, and I provided written documentation based on a prior presentation that I did. But I think it's important to call out a few points on that. We looked at the assessment consortia that we participated in, and we did there was a gross comparison made in that assessment consortia on the cost of assessments. Within a 31-state grouping, Oregon's costs were fifth lowest at a rate of about $15 per student, while the average state pays about $31 per student for testing. And then I further broke down those costs by OAKS, which are our online assessments, which are $2.90 per test or $13.37 per student. Our writing performance, and we generate about 1.6 million of those tests per year. Our writing performance assessment is about $17 a test or per student and per test, and there's about 160,000 of those per year. There's typically only one writing assessment per student. And our English language proficiency assessment, which is the ELPA that I described earlier, is about $21 per student or test. Where we're going, as you're probably well aware, the State Board of Education adopted the Common Core State Standards. And as you're also aware, hopefully from this presentation, as you change your content standards, you have to revisit your assessment. So we're looking at joined a common assessment consortia, the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortia, which is in the process of designing an assessment that's aligned to those new content standards. A lot of work needs to be done in that area. My office is working with other offices in the department as well as across the state to develop a transition plan to move from the current Oregon standards to the Common Core standards and figure out what that testing change is going to look like. Right now we're going to be testing on the Oregon standards until 13-14, and in 14-15 students will be expected to be tested and results will be posted on the new Common Core standards using these new common assessments. So there's a lot of work to be done there, and that's a lot of messy stuff. We're a member of the governing board of the Smarter Balance Consortia. You can see some of their guiding principles, and again, I want to point out that there's a point of integration between the Common Core standards and the common assessments. And finally, in conclusion, just summarize that, you know, we believe we've provided accurate, timely, and cost-effective information on how well our kids are doing across the state, and that it's important that we provide a common external measure of student achievement, and that assessment should stimulate the dialogue among educators at all levels about the best way to help each student reach challenging academic targets. And we ought to be focusing on the growth of individual students. And finally, on the last page, I wanted to point out that this again is a broad topic, and we can go into a lot more details. And I'm happy to answer whatever questions I can on these details that you want to know about. I also wanted to give a credit to Wayne Neuberger, Michael Dalton, and Bill Lowdy, three of my predecessors, who developed a document on the history of assessment in Oregon back in 2006. Much of this information came from that work. And I also wanted to point you to the technical documentation on our website, so that if you get questions from folks about how are these things built, there's actually 10 volumes of technical documentation supporting all of our various assessments, how they're built, how they're administered, what the test blueprints look like, etc. So I thank you for your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Doug. It's, you know, it is getting increasingly complex, and I say that as a positive, but I think if somebody would have walked in here after you started, they would have had a hard time understanding that you were actually talking about education. My question is, all school districts do the OAKS? Or how is it that some can do a variation of that, or am I incorrect?
Senator Haas, I don't know of anybody that does a variation of OAKS. Now, there is a variation of OAKS, or other options can be used for the purpose of demonstrating proficiency on the high school diploma, but for accountability purposes, they all have to use the OAKS assessment.
And how does that interface with the private schools?
Private schools are not required to report under accountability, and through our regional help desk contracts, we have allowed those regional support centers to offer the assessment at no charge from our side to these private schools, but they in turn are allowed to charge a nominal fee for connecting those students into the assessment and providing the secure administration facility.
So do they do that?
Some do, yes. And we don't keep the results on the private schools.
Right. In the charter schools?
Charter schools are tested as a public school, so we keep the results on those.
Okay. Senator Bonamici, this is one of your subjects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I really appreciate the conversation, and it's always a learning process. I went back and looked at some of my notes when we were discussing not only Senate Bill 801, but Senate Bill 974, and it really, I think, My concern is about the difference between formative and summative assessments, and I'm just looking at some information that was sent to me from one of my colleagues in the House about how formative is really more focused on evaluating a student's needs and progress along a continuum of knowledge in order to adjust instruction, and summative tests are more primarily used to, as Representative Frederick actually said, as a hammer, to say that a state, a school district, a school, or a teacher, or a student has failed. And so I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about moving toward more helpful formative assessments that really help the students rather than just measure for purposes of rating. Can we talk a little bit about how we can move in that direction?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici would be happy to. There's a couple of different avenues that I want to talk about with respect to formative assessments. But before I do, I would like to suggest that for every person that you talk to about formative assessment, they will have a slightly different definition. It's one of those things that's really hard to get nailed down on exactly what it is. I think the definition that you laid out was very clear and specific. I think it's a good one. I would like to also say that summative assessments are not typically intended to be focused on creating a hammer for kids. These are more system-level assessments, and we're typically using them with respect to evaluating systems and programs. But given all of that, I want to make the committee aware that we have been working with the University of Oregon on taking a formative assessment that they call a formative assessment called EZCBM, and many districts across the state are using that assessment, and we worked with them to get a federal grant to integrate our student registration system into it so that they would have an easier mechanism for getting the information and logging into this assessment, making it more technically feasible. So we're working with Jerry Tyndall again in his office to take that to the next level. The other area that's being worked on for formative assessment is in the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortia. So if you think about the work that those folks are doing, there's three major types of assessment that they're going to build. The first they will build is the summative assessment, which is going to be the OAKS replacement. Then the next one will be an interim assessment, which will be basically a periodic or interim assessment that provides incremental information on a student's progress toward the summative assessment. And then from what I understand, and we're not clear at this point because they're still designing the business requirements for the formative assessment component, it's going to be more of a definition and clarification of the purpose and guidelines for best practices around formative assessment. So it may not be a tool or a resource specifically, but it would likely, it could be more of a set of guidelines and appropriate uses of those assessment. The other piece of the SBAC is it's supposed to be more instructionally relevant. We have on that committee experts, including Linda Darling Hammond, who is a formative assessment expert and really is hammering hard on the genuine instructionally related assessment processes and procedures. So what we'll see in those new assessments, we believe, will be more task-based, informational type of assessments that provide, you know, learning opportunities for kids. It's not going to be strictly multiple choice. There will be constructed response and brief constructed response in addition to the multiple choice typical type of assessments that we administer. Does that help?
It does help. I guess I wonder, you said that the first step is in the Smarter Balance Consortium is to work on a sort of the OAKS replacement, which is summative. I guess I'm hoping that not too much time is spent on that since we're, yeah. I think the focus should be on the more formative.
Yeah, Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, I appreciate that. And I think that there are different groups working on different pieces. And when I say their primary focus, I think they're spending, I think what I've heard is about $90 million developing the item pool, which are the bank of questions. And that's a huge amount of work to do and get those field tested and scaled in an appropriate format. So then the interim assessment work can go along in parallel. But as they're building those items for the summit of assessments, they're also building items that could be used for that interim assessment process as well. And I will say that our assessment director, Tony Alpert, I don't know if you got to meet him the other day, he's one of the executive directors on that or the key governing board states on that consortia. So he's extremely knowledgeable about the day-to-day activities. We could bring him back and he could give you way more detail than I could on that process.
Thank you. And I just as a brief follow-up, I know I've talked with you about this, Doug, but when I was first many years ago learning about adaptive testing as a parent, the parents in the school could not understand why every child wasn't taking the same test. It was very confusing to them. I mean, my child is taking a different test from somebody else and trying to explain that the next question depends on how they answer the current question, and each test is different. It is very hard to communicate to people, but once you understand what adaptive testing is, you understand that you have to have a really good, well-developed, valid pool of questions or the adaptive testing doesn't work, and that's probably really general knowledge. But
just to build on that a little bit, that's a good way to paint it, Chair Haas, Representative, or Senator Bonamici. The item pool that we develop are, if you can imagine, there are easy items, medium items, and very difficult items. They each have a different scale score, or they affiliate with a different scale score. So if you get a couple of really difficult questions right, you're going to crank up your scale, your possible score at the end of the day, as opposed to missing one or two on the little lower level type of responses.
Okay. Well, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
I appreciate this.
Thank you.
This is all right. That clears our calendar for the day, committee. We have a very full agenda on Thursday, and again, likely on Tuesday, our last 2 days of this committee as far as work sessions goes, probably our last 2 days. So get a good night's sleep. We are adjourned.